The Naturalistic Decision-Making Podcast with Brian Moon and Laura Militello. This podcast series brings you interviews with leading NDM researchers who study and support people who make decisions under stress. Welcome to the Naturalistic Decision-Making Podcast. This is Laura Militello from Applied Decision Science.
And I'm Brian Moon for Perigean Technologies.
Today we welcome Thomas Landthaler. Thomas is an experienced crisis manager, facilitator, and author. For the past two decades, he's worked in over 30 countries, started two companies, and published his first book last summer called Navigating Beyond Crisis. He currently manages the leadership development of a global holding company. He advises companies globally on leadership and learning, and has turned his passion for human dynamics into his profession, specializing in designing and facilitating experiential learning arenas. He constantly strives to get new perspectives, and his approach is heavily influenced by his work and time spent with Indigenous peoples. He currently resides in Norway, where he gets inspired by his two most excellent teachers, as he calls them, his children. Welcome, Thomas. Thank you for joining us today.
So good to be here. Thank you, Laura. Hi, Brian.
Yeah, so I wanted to just start out and ask you if you could tell us a little bit about crisis management. I've never studied this domain. We hear, you know, on the news about these people that respond to disasters, and I just wondered if you could tell us a little bit about what it's like to be one of those responders.
Crisis management is, in a way, it's a very broad field. I mean, there's a technical domain, which is what you might often hear about. But in a way, we're all doing it. That's kind of the first thing I would say. And you know, there's smaller crises that we have everybody in our lives. I think the domain itself is really about dealing with large scale situations that are usually triggered by incidents. And the way I interpret that doesn't necessarily match everybody else's interpretation, but the way I look upon crisis, it's the situations where systemic change is inevitable. So basically, like, a lot of things have to be turned around, and that requires management. So it's, in a way, it's an extreme form of change management, if you want.
Interesting. So, like, in your experience, what does a crisis team look like?
A crisis team is ideally, very often in practice, what it looks like is in companies, it would be rather senior people that carry a lot of responsibility within a company that would then try to really work out solutions for the situation that you're facing. Ideally, I think there's weaknesses to this approach. I think these people also have other responsibilities in the company, and a lot of them would actually be naturally involved in business continuity. So in my world, a crisis team looks like a lot of diverse people, meaning different age groups, different backgrounds, different seniority within a company or an organization, different professions, because that gives you actually a way broader spectrum of how to develop solutions. It gives you approaches to the situation that might be not necessarily what you immediately see, but from a different angle. And the team is rather agile in a way, so they can work together in different forms and different shapes. And I think also crisis teams ideally have facilitators, which are people that are not necessarily involved in handling the crisis directly, but they guide the process, which would relieve the leader of this team, the crisis managers. They're often referred to from tasks, from responsibilities, and actually get that they can focus really on the situation.
I see. And so I think I was imagining a group of people who are responding immediately as something occurs, and it's kind of an intense short-term thing. But what you're describing sounds like it might be sustained over time. This might be a lengthy crisis.
There's the immediate response when there's a crisis of different shapes. Maybe that's where I should start. So some are triggered by incidents. Like, that's a lot of those I worked with, whether it's an earthquake or whether it's a disease outbreak or similar things, they go from 0 to 100 very quickly. But then you have those crises that are coming slowly, that you might have been able to do something about already beforehand when you look back. That's the sad part. Often when we look back, we're a lot wiser. And the crisis management for me goes over a long period of time. So sometimes this can go over months. And if we talk about really as crisis management as a change process, it also is about implementing the solutions that we're having. And that can take time. So crisis teams, yes, you might have the incident management team that really focuses on a particular situation here and now, but then they should work agile because sometimes they wear themselves out. Sometimes this can take over a long time. Take, for example, COVID. The COVID situation was a very long one, and if there would only be one crisis team working with that over a long period of time, that would not be effective, and certainly not for their mental and physical health.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I'm imagining this crisis team, in some situations, you're even trying to frame the problem, make sure you understand what the problem is or what the highest priority things are, as well as then how to respond to them. But part of it is just, how do I frame the situation? Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think what is key in those situations, personally, when I worked as a crisis manager, but also later on as a consultant and trainer for these topics, is that I really work on this problem definition part. Because what I notice a lot is that the teams or the leadership in companies, they identify the problem very often externally attributed. So contextual problems as the crisis. But the crisis is actually that the system that they're in isn't able to cater for the new rules or the changes in the environment. So when you define the problem close to your home and in a way that it's in a scope that you can influence it, you actually have a lot more option to work with. And that requires a little bit of reframing, that requires really diving into this. And we have often problem definitions where I would ask, so is there anything you can do about this? And when the answer is no, then it's like, well, maybe it's not your problem or it's not accurately formulated. And that's when we really get to the core. And the moment they can do something about it, you also have a very different approach to managing a crisis because you take the ownership back. And the other problem that might have not been formulated correctly, you might still be able to handle it, but maybe as a consequence of the first actions that you're doing.
Interesting. So that question, can you do anything about it, helps you figure out if you've framed this in a constructive way.
It's this. It's what I refer to in my book as the zone of leverage, right? We all have that. And sometimes it seems, I'll give you an example, sticking with COVID, I always bring that example. When I talk to people in the beginning of COVID, they would say, well, my problem is the travel restrictions because I can't do my job anymore. I can't travel. And so I would ask, so is that really something you can do anything about? And like, no, I can't do anything about the travel restrictions. So what's really your problem then? And after a few rounds, we would actually get to the point, formulating it as a question first and foremost. So what can I do to continue my work with the travel restrictions being in place? So you completely shifted your focus back to something that, what is it that I can do? And simply that those two things, first and foremost, going onto your scope of influence and formulating it as a question, is a completely different approach than how often problems are being formulated. Because you think very differently when you ask something in a question, and when you actually look at yourself, like, so what is it that I can do? You're immediately on the solution focus.
Interesting. Yeah, that makes so much sense. So most people run from crises. I'm wondering how you found your way into this career. Tell me about how you got started.
There's a bit of a detour in a way. I always knew I wanted to work abroad. I studied political science and had this dream of being a foreign correspondent and a war reporter. I don't know why I was drawn to these contexts, but this fascinated me. I think I read a book once. It was a novel about a war reporter a long time ago. And that caught me. And so I found that fascinating. But I wasn't good enough of a journalist. And so I found my different ways. I got coincidentally into a training on mediation. Wow, that's interesting. So I came in from that angle and started to work as a volunteer in South Africa in a small NGO that worked with local conflict resolution. So that was basically my way out of Austria, where I was born. And the moment I was out of Austria and got a bit of a taste of the wide world, I didn't want to go back, really. I just wanted to explore more. And then I got the position offered in Afghanistan, of all places. Looking back, I was too young for a context like that. For me, it went well, but I was 26 or something when I went there, advising a local NGO on alternative conflict resolution methods. And Afghanistan being a war context, it's a very fine line between anything you do and crisis management. So it was, once you're in the field, in the humanitarian field, it's a bit of a domino. So you're there and then you get offered another position, and because you're already there and they're looking for people. And that's how I got slowly more into crisis management. So from conflict work over to first a bit of risk management, a bit of security work, and then later on got more and more into crisis response, crisis preparedness, and crisis management after that.
Interesting. So you started out with political science, which is somewhat about systems and conflict a lot. And then that mediation, that you were drawn to that as well.
I love mediation. I think mediation is that's still where my heart in a way lies. I have not worked with it now much over the past years, other than training and conflict work. But I like this, the way working with people. This is also what in your introduction, when you said, like, I love human dynamics, and conflicts are situations when human dynamics are brutally exposed. And it's kind of similar in crisis. It's just a bit of a different context. And that probably fascinates me about it. And crisis management, and that's also very honest, is also a bit addictive. Honestly, it's a very adrenaline-driven job. You immediately see impact of the things that you're doing. You're a bit drawn to that because it's high pace. It gives you immediately a sense of purpose, and that makes it a bit addictive too. So if you're not taking care of yourself, that's actually a bit dangerous. And that's also why I had to take a break after 10, 12 years that I did this, because I felt mentally and physically tired.
So Thomas, tell us about one of these crisis management experiences that you did find particularly fulfilling. It sounds like you've had many, but are there any that stick out to you as really sort of personally and professionally fulfilling?
Sticking out is very, very difficult. I mean, I was in Syria at the beginning of the war. That was now 10 years ago, a bit more than that, 12 years almost ago, where the war was, it wasn't really a war back then. It was more a civil unrest, so to say, the first protests going on. But I was then working for UN agency, and we were preparing for potential scenarios that could happen out of this. Also looking at the Arab Spring back then, other countries. And I was the last person that got a visa coming into the country to support that office in that work. And that was very fulfilling because we all knew something was going to come, and they were in desperate need for this support. So for this advice, for someone who had the expertise to help them set up an operation for different scenarios that we built out. So we had lots of work, and for my part, it was an incredibly interesting experience because of the dynamics within Syria, because of a lot of challenges when it comes to how the government interacted with us, when my individual role, because you had to really do a lot of stakeholder navigation because some people were in favor of the government, others were not. So there was a lot of learning, a lot of dealing with people, but the impact afterwards was, of course, sadly, a big one, because the preparations were really one of the reasons we could continue the operations after that and after the war really break out. And it's sad, but for me, that was very fulfilling to be able to contribute to that work continue there.
It sounds very confusing just listening to you describe it. Can you tell us a bit about the stakeholders you did work with and sort of what roles you take on with each stakeholder group?
So I would go into this country, and that would of course be the advisor to the country office of that agency. So in this case, it was the World Food Program, and their operations was of course providing food for refugees in different camps outside of the capital of Damascus. So my stakeholder relations would primarily be the country office, but then we also had the stakeholders of course partner organizations that were other organizations that worked with us in terms of logistics, in terms of communication. Then of course there was the government. There was own ministers assigned to the work that the World Food Program was doing. So we would relate to those people. Then also the stakeholders within WFP, within the country office, were individuals that were, on the one hand, very much in favor of the government. So they would also report things that we would discuss about the government. And then you would have stakeholders who would very much be against the government. And those would really push for being more aggressive, being more open. And we had to navigate all these people to get an effective preparedness without revealing too much. So there was a lot of trust involved. There was a lot of difficult decisions that we had to make behind closed doors. And we had to really decide who to invite to those meetings, and a lot of dilemma situations.
Well, it sounds like the trust piece is potentially even more complex with the stakeholders introducing some deception about their intents and that sort of thing. Is that another hard part?
Absolutely. That's a hard part everywhere, because one of the misconceptions about the humanitarian field is just about helping. But ultimately, it's a very complex system. It's you enter this, and there's a lot of individual interests, not least the organizations that are going in. So whether it's Red Cross, the United Nations, smaller NGOs, they would still come in and have their own interests and their own ideas of how we can help, where can we position ourselves so that we really have the most impact, because that also needs to be visible to their donors and the people that give them money. And there's a lot of relationship management and trust in the sense of how much information you give away, which decisions you make. That is always a tricky thing in every context. In some, it's a bit easier because it's maybe not so sensitive. There, it's more turf fighting. But in conflict situations, it's always sensitive because you ultimately relate with different actors, and in some situations, that can be both conflict parties.
So in a situation like that, your primary goal is distributing food. Is that right?
It's distributing food, and depending on if you have any other services. But in that situation that I mentioned, it was distributing food, and it was keeping the organization, keeping the operations running in the first place. Because if they would stop you from, for example, exiting the capital, you would not be able to go anymore to distribute food. So that's kind of the distribution of food is in a way the mandate that we have. But the smaller decisions are keeping the fleet going, being able to travel, being able to keep the independence. Because of course, if you're seen with the government protecting you, that does something on the perception of the organization, and you basically might put your people at risk to the other conflict party. So there's a lot of these operational decisions along the way, and it's very similar to a lot of military decisions, only with a different mandate.
So every time you take an action or share a bit of information, part of what you're doing is anticipating what unanticipated things might happen based on whatever you're doing or saying, which sounds really complicated. And so I guess I'm wondering, like, you had to learn all these skills on the job? This is, you know, not something you would have learned in a political science degree or something.
That's all on the job training. Nothing prepared, not even the courses that you do before prepared you for that. And in later years, this was a little bit my core topic to how can we actually prepare people for these situations. So how can you actually illustrate decision making in the complexity that they might face it? Also, because we've only examples from the past. So every future crisis in this sense is an unknown, so you don't really know which complexity they might face. And so for me, every single crisis that I was in is a new one, and I can draw from my previous experience to some extent, but then I really have to work a lot with scenarios. I have to work a lot with patience, which is one of the key skills, I think, for crisis managers. I see often that people are too impatient and want to make very quick decision and have this mindset that there's no time. But I always say, like, if it's not a life or death situation, there's always time. And might be more or less, but there's always time to take a step back and just reflect again and let it play through your mind, what you know, what you don't know, how it feels. And in my book, I write a lot about confidence, which is one of the things that I think I'm trying to focus on when it comes to decision making, and get that confidence in your decision that you're not later on, what you often hear on the news when people say, like, oh, if I would have to make the same decision again with the information I have now, I would not do it. Yes, but that's not the same decision. So it's often this, like, would you do the same decision with the same information again? And how confident are you about it? And that's my indicators. So it's not the additional information that I blind out. It's more like the decision that you took back then with the information you had available. Would you do that again? And even if the outcome wasn't a good one. And if people say yes, then I know there was a lot of confidence. And then we can work on where this confidence came from. And this is kind of the ambition that I have with my work around this topic.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about these experiential learning exercises you put together. It sounds really fascinating.
I like experiential learning because it's for me, I noticed over the years that we learn a lot cognitively. So we will learn a lot with our heads and reflect and think and try to put information together. But I lacked a little bit the sustainability of those. And when I myself was exposed to experiences that were not even labeled learning experiences, but those were the things that you experience with your whole body, that you really like, you, that they set in your bones, the emotional responses you have, the how you feel in these situations. That's what stuck with me. That's where I got the learning from. That's why I really, when I look back at this, I still feel it. And what I want to recreate is situations like that. I want to, it's almost immersive experience, but of course on a simpler scale, when I do a workshop, I don't have all the means that many of these immersive experience designers have, but I try to make experience where people really feel that they are in the situation, and not necessarily that they are on the ground in Afghanistan or somewhere, but they feel the dilemma and they feel the difficulty, how it is to decide those things, how it feels to actually discuss it, how it feels after you have decided, because that sticks with them. Because later on, when we talk about it, that's what they refer to, the feelings, the emotions, and they actually move a little bit away from the decision. And I like to work with emotions and feelings because I think that's a huge part of learning.
Yeah. As you're talking, there's a phrase I've been reading lately, cognitive fidelity. And so this idea of, can we create a learning experience where people are feeling the same kinds of pressures and tensions and conflicting priorities as they would in the real world? And maybe some kinds of training, you really want to focus on that cognitive experience and getting that kind of fidelity into your scenario more than the physical fidelity. Like, it doesn't have to be, you don't have to feel like you're in a desert. It's more important that you are really feeling those pressures and complexities that you have to manage.
I love that expression. I haven't heard it before, but what you just described is basically exactly what I'm trying to achieve from my work. And that can be a simple, inverted commas, desk exercise where you simulate a plane crash, and then you have space in your car for three of the people, and you might have to assume that the others die. And the discussions, this might happen in a humanitarian context. So I worked on this with this scenario on leaders. And then you have basically, you don't have much time to decide either, because you have to move on. You still have a large way to go. There's no additional information available. And what I always notice, and this is where this exciting training experience comes from, is there's so little information in this exercise. So people fill their contexts with assumptions. And this is then when I come in and ask them about their confidence at the end of it, because they add on things that were nowhere written. And I said, so what if you would take all these away? Would you still be as confident in your decisions? So it's really about more, it's more illustrating about them, how we think, how we react in these situations. And because this is such a inconvenient feeling, they, of course, nobody's going to die in this exercise, but it doesn't feel good to still talk about it. It sits with them afterwards. And we're not in the desert anywhere, but that feeling is very real. And I often have to do a lot of debriefs and discussions afterwards on how people feel, because those are not necessarily convenient exercises, but they also prepare them for going to the field and having this experience potentially out there.
Yeah, so I want to talk about emotions. One of the things I found really compelling about your book, that's really front and center, the kinds of emotions people feel, how they deal with them. And I, as an NDM researcher, people are always asking me about emotions and decision making, and I never quite know what to say. So I really learned a lot reading your book. And I wondered if you'd just talk a little bit about some of your insights based on your experiences about the role emotions can play when you have to make decisions in these high stakes environments, both positive and negative.
Emotions are, I had really, this is one of the things where my professional journey and my life journey, I think in parallel, where my opinion really changed over the years. So I was brought up in the school within crisis management that is, you have to make rational decisions and blind out your emotions. And somehow that never sat right with me. Because every time I was in these crisis situations, I was basically confronted with emotions left, right, and center, whether it was my own, or whether it was the people that we would help, or whether it was my crisis team. And they didn't all have the same emotional reactions. So at one point, I started to actually turn that a little bit around and say, like, so what if we worked with them? Instead of doing an unnatural thing, parking the emotions when they're already there and when they're so strong, why don't we work with them? Because some of the things that I've also experienced was, if you're not working with them, they just come back a lot stronger. And then I found them actually harder to work with. So I looked a little bit on how we could work with them. And for me, simplified, emotions are in a way an indicator. They have a function in our being. And if you actually think about what that function is, then it's an indicator for something that either is right or is wrong, or something that's triggered within us. And so I found when exploring these emotions, sometimes there would be actually solutions hidden behind what I can do to either calm that emotion down. Sometimes it would even be solutions for the problems that we're facing. Or sometimes, if we didn't have any of that, simply the acknowledgement of, like, it's okay to be, for example, afraid helps, because it's not dealt as with something that's forbidden, that you shouldn't do, that's a bit like dismissed, but it's okay to be afraid. And that is just, that's an empowering feeling. So I have actually really, I'm advocating, and I'm a strong, a strong believer in that working with emotions, it's not necessarily that you need to make an emotional decision. But if you do before you make a decision, if you actually go into that field and say, so, what do you feel now? And yeah, I'm afraid or I'm uncertain or any other reaction you have, you can explore that a little bit. And I have noticed, as many people that I worked with, that that actually increases your confidence in the decision. It doesn't necessarily cloud your judgment, but it basically is like, okay, there's the emotional sphere. I have been seen. I can now make my decision.
So when you are talking with someone very inexperienced, who's going to be working in these kinds of domains, what kind of advice do you have for them about emotions?
I always say, like, it starts with yourself. So every crisis management starts and ends in a way with yourself. So you're coming in to deal with a situation, but ultimately there will be you're there before and you're there after. And so I really, really give them tools and advise them to look a lot in the mirror and be honest about how they're feeling and actually not even hide that. I was in the beginning also, I was very uncertain when I was young and inexperienced. And I said before, I think I ended in these situations probably too young. I mean, in my case, it was a very steep learning curve, but I don't think anybody has to have that. I was not showing my emotions at all. I was actually denying that I had these emotions. I was trying to be all rational. But what, as a consequence, I wasn't really in contact with what really happened within me in that situation. So that's the first advice, like learn how to look in the mirror and be honest about it. And the second thing is you don't have to do everything alone. This is the other thing. Crisis managers keep telling me like it's very lonely at the top, but that's often a homemade problem because it's an overfelt sense of responsibility. Usually you have teams around you. We are hardly ever in professionals field that we have to manage crisis alone. So you usually have people around you and they each have their own experience, perspective, and they each are there to actually support each other. So make use of the people around you, and that requires sharing vulnerability in the sense of also being open about what's going on within you, but also try to find ways on how you can address emotional things, how you can actually find solutions, spaces where you can really have these interactions. And those are small tips, but they're rather simple to implement, and they usually have a big effect.
Nice. So kind of the number one thing is get comfortable with just recognizing that you are having emotions and putting a name to those. And then it sounds like another piece in there is finding ways to share those emotions in constructive ways with team members.
Make space for them. And another thing that I would also say, like, even in the worst situations, try to work with humor. I find humor is such a powerful tool because it distracts. It's very simple. It's like when it gets really difficult, when you're stuck, when you're feeling like you're not moving forward, it becomes too much. And if you somehow manage to get humor into this, and there's little exercises that you can do, one that comes to mind is what I call a frustration garbage can, where you basically you're allowed for 5 minutes to just be as open about your frustrations and actually exaggerate them, what really annoys you at this moment. And it always ends with laughter. And the moment the laughter is there, the situation is slightly diffused, the tension is a bit out, motivation comes back, and you're actually getting a bit of a push inside. So humor is a very, very powerful tool, even in crisis. And a lot of people would say like, oh, it's too serious, but I haven't been in a crisis where there was no space for humor.
Wow, that sounds really powerful, the frustration trash can, a way to just say what you're feeling, even if it's exaggerated, and that can actually relieve some of the stress, it sounds like, and turn to laughter.
It's a very powerful, simple tool that is that usually ends up almost being a bit of a stand-up comedy format where people then just go all in and, you know, just really try to exaggerate. There's only one rule, like no direct attacks on each other, of course. But if you just really like, oh, and this annoys me, and it annoys me so much. And if you just purposefully exaggerate, and always creates laughter, and that usually is a very good diffuser.
Right. So I have worked with, in lots of domains, and I'm thinking about some interviews I did with Army helicopter pilots, and they talked about sometimes a new person in their first conflict would just freeze up. And so the more experienced person had all these techniques for helping the person, you know, calm down, breathe slowly. They would give them one small task to pay attention to carefully until they could not feel so overwhelmed. I'm wondering, do you have techniques for like recognizing that someone is getting overwhelmed or that their emotions are becoming too big and ways to kind of help them manage that?
It's very similar. I would even like go a step further and add a word of caution to what the helicopter pilots say, because in at least in the humanitarian sphere, it's not only people that are not experienced or less experienced, because I've also seen people being triggered by a past trauma or a past situation that they've been in being triggered, and actually the reaction was only released later on, and those were experienced things. Just to give you a very quick example, I was in a car once with a colleague 25 years experience in all sorts of humanitarian contexts, done lots of trainings, and a very, very tough woman. You could drop her anywhere. Basically, that was the label that she has made for herself. And we were in the car and approached a checkpoint somewhere in Africa. I think it was in South Sudan. And she all of a sudden broke out in a hysterical laughter. She's also a reaction. It's not a freeze, but it's basically a stress reaction. And we were just like, we didn't really know what to do because we already were at the checkpoint and we tried to calm her down. And she wanted to calm down, but she couldn't. And later on, I learned that that had to do with breathing. I mean, that situation ended well. We managed to defuse it. And afterwards, she broke out in tears because she said, I was almost a prisoner of myself in that situation. She watched herself from the outside and couldn't do anything about it. And neither could we. But later on, as I said, I learned that this has actually to do with breathing. And in stress situations, we breathe differently and kind of have to get an oxygen flow going. And laughter is one of those things that actually helps apparently about that. So the things that you mentioned are also the things that we are using. So it's either removing the person from the situation or breathing exercises, calming down. I really loved the one which you said, giving them a task to refocus, like something that in a way has nothing to do with the crisis directly, but that is actually something that occupies their mind. And it goes along the lines of some of the things that I also always recommend. It's really the method of anchoring. It's basically a little method that when you watch children would go from A to B when they're very small, and they would always carry stuff. I mean, Linus from Charlie Brown is a perfect example there. He has his cuddle blanket. The only function of those things is actually to give you an anchor, to give you something to hold on to. It's the same as when we do presentations, right? We have something, sometimes we have the remote control for the beamer or anything. And they would also serve as an anchor. And you can do that in teams as well. It doesn't have to be something physical, but it can be your purpose, the purpose of the team. And those things, they can calm you down because they give you a grounding in a way. And they actually help you to refocus. And the moment you refocus, you're a bit taken out of that stress reaction. Doesn't always work, but some of these things, they can help.
Nice. So another topic in your book that really caught my attention was the notion that we're all born with resilience and that there are strategies you use sometimes to foster resilience in both an individual and in an organization. And so I wondered if you'd talk a little bit about that.
I think resilience is something that, and that's also what I say in my book, is that we're born with. Sure, we're small babies, we're dependent more on others, but later on we have these natural ways of coping with things. And take the pandemic. In the beginning, everybody was like, this is going to be difficult. You know, you're going to be the lockdowns and everything. And within a few days, people started to put out photos of their home gyms and all sorts of things they did at home, which is resilience in practice, if you want. Also, what has really shown me that we all have a strong sense of resilience is in some of these places that I've worked, they have been in devastating crisis for decades. And there was people actually living in conditions that are unthinkable for many of us. And still they manage. And not only that, they actually have a life. So before I came to Afghanistan, I was pictured like this was going to be a complete, almost like World War II pictures at the end of the war when everything was bombed. But then I came there and it was a very vibrant life and everyday life. And yes, there was a war, a conflict going on, but still people worked through it. So that's kind of the starting point of my thinking. And when I work with organizations and when I work with individuals, leaders primarily, I try to actually really emphasize that there is tools that they can use. There's mindsets that they can build that help them being resilient, whether it's effective ways of learning. I mean, we all learn slightly different, but if you find effective ways of learning and know how you learn, you actually learn quick in a crisis situation, might adapt quicker because you know what you need and you know what you're looking for. Or I'm a huge fan of MacGyver, to bring also another character into this. And I think the way this TV show portrayed the kind of solving problems or solving crisis is the mindset. It's basically just constantly thinking about what else can I do in this situation? What other options do I have now to solve this problem? Simple things like if you take a glass, if you take anything on your desk and say like, so what functional attribution do I have to this and what other things can I do with it? So glass is a perfect example where, yeah, we can drink from it, but we can also use it as listening through the wall. We can fill it up with things to carry. So there's so many other things we can do. And simply that mindset, if you practice that within the team, you will immediately see a lot more options and a lot more solutions in a crisis situations because you think always, what else can we do? So those are a few things. Resource inventory. Be aware of what resources have available. I have never, ever worked with a team or an organization that was aware of all its resources, because we're focusing too much on what we see and we forget always what we don't see, which is also resources, whether it's languages, whether it's experiences, connections, all those things. And if you do that practice that constantly, it contributes to your resilience because you know what you have available, you're way more confident. So those would be a few things that I'd advise.
Nice. So I'm just going to kind of recap. So one was, you talked about mindsets. And so you said this idea that if you become more aware of how you learn, you can make the most of the experiences that come up and learn from them. Mm-hmm. And then you talked about if there are objects, thinking about creative ways to use them for different functions. So glass doesn't just have to be a water glass. You might be able to use it for lots of different things. And so doing mental exercises that help you think about how to use objects for many different functions. And then you talked about the resource inventory, like thinking about what is available to help solve this problem, not what's not available. What do I have here?
What do we have? And also what is it that we don't see? Mm. So simple exercise for anybody listening with your team, ask yourself if you know how many languages are spoken in your team. My guess is that you don't, because we are not always going around like I speak this and this and this languages, but every language competency can potentially be a resource in a crisis or a difficult situation, or even for new ideas. If we blind out the crisis for a moment, even if you develop new projects, find new clients, can be a resource. And that you can do with a lot of different things. So it's really about this, not stopping to learn, not stopping to find out what it is that you have available, and constantly work on your mindset in the sense of trusting in your abilities and exploring new options.
So Thomas, the way you're explaining your work with regard to the pressures, the context that you've been working in, the various stakeholders working within teams, I mean, these are all sort of NDM hallmarks for us in terms of the kinds of folks that we're used to working with in the community. And then your comments about experiential learning and setting up those difficult scenarios, again, another approach that we suggest in the NDM community. I'm curious, many of us became aware of your work when you came to the conference back in October of 2022. And I just remember hearing lots of buzz after your particular workshop about how much people got out of it. But got me thinking, how did you cross paths with the NDM community, and what was sort of your journey to being involved in the community?
It was a fun journey, and I'm really glad that my paths crossed with the NDM community, because I really enjoyed the conference and meeting also people from different sectors and different fields that have the same mindset but come from a different angle, and sharing all this experience back in October. I'm already looking forward to the next one, by the way. But my paths crossed when I started writing my book a bit before that. I was working at home. I was, you know, doing a lot outside. So I listened to a lot of audiobooks. And first I came across Malcolm Gladwell. So this path is going to be one that you might have heard before, but I came across Malcolm Gladwell, who talked about decision making and gut feeling and those things. And then he referenced Gary Klein. And then I got a book from Gary Klein. And this was kind of my first contact with the whole NDM world, which I actually honestly didn't know much about or anything, to be honest. And then I really got very quickly, I got sucked into different topics, different models, different approaches, the work, bit what you referenced now as well. And later on, I reached out to Julie Gore, who I heard on your podcast, and we discussed a few ideas on potential PhD options that I was playing around with around decision making and dilemmas. And she actually referred me to the association. So she said, this is the association, and I should maybe have a look. And then it was not long before the conference actually happened. And that's, so I joined, I think, about a half a year, a few months before that. And it was all related to my book, since there's also a lot about decision making in my book. And that's how it started. And I ended up then joining the association and coming to the conference in October.
Awesome. Yeah, I hope that's a story we hear again and again. But so I'm curious, I heard your path there. And obviously, you know, with picking up on Gary's work and the intuition piece, I'm curious if there's other sort of models or tools that you came across when you were exploring writing the publications, if there's anything that really you gravitated toward because it felt like it was helpful to you in your work, but also really sort of matched the experiences that you were having.
I really liked, and it's also Gary's work. I would say it's still within the NDM frame, but I might have a bit of a different connotation, but that the book Seeing What Others Don't is really spoke to me, because one of the paths that he referenced on how we gain insights is something that I heavily worked with before, and I still use a lot, which is what he called creative desperation. So that model is something that it's incredibly relevant for crisis management, and it's incredibly relevant for learning for me anyway, because that's a lot of the approaches that I use. Creative desperation, quickly explained, is in a way the idea that we throw overboard our mental models when we have no other option. So our behavior is driven by mental models, and when we're really in a corner, when we have tried every other solution, then we actually start to think differently and deconstruct those mental models because we're desperate to find a solution. He references firefighters that actually ran into the fire instead of away and survived it because they had all of a sudden a very different idea of how they could solve, and they found a new way of surviving in very difficult wildfires, for example, and other things. So that really spoke to me. It's a little bit outside those models that you're probably referencing to, but that's something that's very relevant for my work. And of course, the recognition prime and all those, they are very, very relevant for what I do.
So I love that phrase, creative desperation. It kind of, to me, it evokes this situation. You find yourself in this situation where your existing mental models don't work anymore. They're not relevant. The world has changed in some really important way, and you have to let go of what just felt like the truth, you know, and do something different.
That's exactly what it is. And I think that's something you can practice, going a bit back to that resilience question, because I think you can also, by the simple question, what else can we do? You might already have found a solution and you're happy with that, but just playing around, like, what else could we do? And often when you found a solution, this is a lot easier done because you have, the pressure is gone of, I have still to solve the problem because you have already done that. But then it's like, just let's play around. What else could we do? And this might not always be the same insights that you get as you get through that creative desperation part, but still it's starting to open up your world, your realities, your thinking, and you actually allowed to deconstruct the mental models and actually invited to do so instead of having to end up in a corner and then doing it.
Yeah. So we've been talking a lot about your past. I'm wondering what's next for you. What are some of the challenges you're looking forward to exploring next in life?
I know I recently took over that leadership management portfolio of this global holding that I'm working for now. I needed a bit of a break from kind of being a full-time consultant. I still do consultancy work on the side. And it's about building up leadership development model. And I have this ambition of taking a lot of the things from the NDM world into that, whether it's the cognitive task analysis, because I actually, that's probably outside this podcast, but I really want to play around with that a little bit within the leadership development field. Of course, the decision-making part. So I try to make this very experiential. So that's a bit for me on the agenda now. I hope I get the space and don't meet too many internal barriers for that, but I'll give it a try. And I continue on the side to do trainings and a lot of fun projects for hopefully around topics such as decision making, such as competency development and others.
Yeah, I can imagine that the trainings you put together for the leadership folks will be really compelling because you're able to pull in all these experiences from your crisis management world. And so even if those aren't the same kinds of things they're going to manage, the kind of intensity and that cognitive fidelity, those elements would still be very valuable.
I try to integrate those, of course, depending on who we work with. But I want to think bigger, right? I just really want to also pass these skills on that I will definitely promote a lot the NDM world, also its models and its ideas, because I think that's, at least from where I'm standing and even outside the crisis world, I think those are very relevant for operations, such as it's a shipping holding that I'm working for. So a lot of that work is very relevant. And I think there's a lot to take out from them. And I'm trying to kind of transfer some of the things that I've learned both in my work before NDM and my approach, but at the same time also after, and just try to combine a journey that they might hopefully enjoy.
Yeah, I can imagine that will be very powerful. So I have another, this is kind of a strange question, but I'm wondering, when you think back over your career and where we are now, are there some changes in the world that have had a really powerful impact on your perspective? I know that a lot of things about this world have changed in the last 20 years. Is there something societal, technological, something that you think has really influenced the way you think?
I'm still one of those generations that have almost half my life lived without mobile phones. I still try to remember how it was when what we actually did when we were in cafes. So this has definitely had an impact. So the whole technology, the World Wide Web, has had an impact, for better or worse, on how we are. But now it's taken a speed where the whole learning and development, the whole competency development has in a way become way more complex. And I try to kind of stay on the basics, but it's getting more and more difficult, which is like human dynamics. I love that. But at the same time, I have to think differently about it. I've had also the privilege to work with environmental organizations, which was a very sad experience for many ways, because the world's not in a good state. And that also has impact on many things, increasing pressure on us, but also personally my mindset. So I really, lots of changes there, lots more awareness, and trying to advocate for more consideration. And also since I became a dad. So there were a couple of those things. But then, of course, these incidents, starting with, for me, the world took a big change with 9/11. I was just beginning of just in my studies and first encounter with crisis management. I was in New York at that time. So I had like this firsthand experience, and also how the world changed afterwards. So there's a few of those incidents along the way, and they keep coming now with Russia. And not everything's negative, because it sounds like only negative events influenced my life, because of course there's positive events too, for example, technology and all those, which I also definitely recognize and think they're very important. But the turning points are unfortunately more visible when you look at the negative parts.
Sure. When you were mentioning technology and human dynamics, I was thinking in some ways technology has changed human dynamics, the way we interact and communicate with each other in really big, big ways.
It definitely has. And like one of my absolute favorite topics is communication psychology. And I started this a while back, and that there was technology was not as advanced as it's now, but you could see the first impact on how we communicate through technology versus how we communicate in real life. Language changes, even though it's kind of the same language, but how you formulate things, how you interpret things. There were a lot of these things. Now a generational dispute is going on. I read this fascinating post the other day where somebody from the so-called Gen Z said, don't call us boomers, or whoever, don't call us. We only want to text. And it's the other way around. If you talk to my parents, for example, they don't want to text, but they want to call. So there's those elements there as well. So technology has definitely impacted a lot, not only in the way we communicate, but there it's very visible.
So Thomas, we're getting kind of close to time here. I think it would be interesting, given all your experiences, to hear if you had two or three people that you've really looked at and thought of, these are the folks that have really influenced my approach or my thinking, or who are your top influences?
This is a very, very difficult question. It almost feels unfair to all the people that influenced my life and my journey to have to pick three. I would immediately say, since I've just talked about communication psychology, one of the people that definitely influenced both my work and the way I look upon the world is a professor that's died a few years ago. Paul Watzlawick is an Austrian psychologist who was working on topics as communication psychology, but what he's actually, so he's known for a book where he dissects a little bit communication psychology, but he also has worked a lot with constructivism, which I think is an interesting topic in terms of the realities are constructed by us individually, and we look upon the same thing from different angles and see different things. So that's definitely some person I would mention. Since I have worked a lot in African countries, and my career started in South Africa, and there I have had the privilege to work in the areas where Nelson Mandela was born. Also, his approach to conflict and his life philosophy is something that definitely influenced me. And then I can't really pick a third person. I will have to pick two, which might be a bit unusual, but that's my two kids. Because since I've become a father, things changed significantly. And a lot of the work that I've done in the past years is actually inspired by observing my kids, whether how they learn, how they make decisions, how they handle uncertainty, which in a way are often attributed to crisis, how our behavior is simple, that they're the basics of human dynamics. And I think there's no more natural way of learning than watching children. So these people definitely, two of them still continue to influence my life, and the other two are the ones that I've mentioned, but there's lots more. So you nailed me down on three, so those are the three that came to mind.
Fair enough. I've seen you post quite a bit about your children, and that's, I think a lot of times we don't bring enough of that sort of thing into our professional work in terms of those near opportunities we have to look around us and find new insights just with the folks we interact with. So I really appreciated you posting some of that. Laura, I'd like to ask the final fun question, if I may.
Do it, yeah.
We had one queued up, but when you were talking earlier about doing stand-up comedy in war zones, I can't pass that up. So our fun question is going to be to put you on the spot and for you to tell us one, or if you've got a couple, one of those comedic moments that you've experienced in contexts where one wouldn't expect you to experience humor. Do you have any sort of stories that stick out about something particularly funny that happened or that someone said, or a routine that you remember?
It was less a comedy routine almost, but it was a dance routine that would come to mind immediately, where we were in Africa in Eastern Congo, and it was really heavy workshop that we did there on systemic conflict analysis of the region. And in the end, we were all very tired and very drained, and we had talked a lot about this. And then ultimately, somebody put on music, and I was kind of the workshop facilitator. So they said, you know, you told us the whole time to lead by example, so you now have to lead by example to get on the stage and dance. And I really tried to refuse, and I, you know, tired and dancing to begin with, but then in front of people. And then I'm just like, okay, I'm going to do this now. And I tried to move. I wouldn't even call it dancing, but I tried to move, and it was very entertaining. And in the beginning, we were 15 people. And I think by the time they finally let me off that stage, I think there were 100 people there. So there was a lot of laughter and a lot of entertainment, at least for the ones watching.
Nice. Please tell us that video is also available somewhere.
I hope not, but maybe, you know.
Awesome.
Well, Thomas, thanks for talking with us today. This has really been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really, really great to talk to you too.
So on that note, thank you for joining us for the NDM podcast. I'm Laura Militello.
And I'm Brian Moon. Learn more about naturalistic decision making and where to follow us by visiting naturalisticdecisionmaking.org.